You are listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 7th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist, and I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on the programme.
I mean, you cannot bring on investment without Europe. You cannot actually tackle any of the existential problems that we have without the European Union.
European conservatives at a congress in Bucharest hold the line on Ukraine and the future of the European Union, but can they fend off the far right in the European Parliament's upcoming elections? We also head to Ukraine, where President Volodymyr Zelensky avoided an assassination attempt. We hear why Venezuela's election announcement isn't really what it seems. And we'll head to Kuala Lumpur ahead of the anniversary of the disappearance of MH370. After all that,
I'm Monocle's Emmanuel Papavassiliou, and I will be speaking about why Greek lawmakers will be voting for an education reform to allow foreign universities to open branches in Greece for the first time.
Looking forward to that. We'll also have an urbanism roundup and a look at the fine print of a Singapore hotel's offer of a free night's stay when it rains. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. This is The Globalist, and I'm Chris Chermak. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. The US Supreme Court says it will hear arguments on whether Donald Trump is immune from prosecution on the 25th of April. Taiwan's defense ministry says China has increased gray zone warfare by saturating the waters surrounding the island. And Australia and Vietnam have upgraded their relations to a comprehensive strategic partnership. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories, but now, voters across the European Union will head to the polls in June for parliamentary elections that could see a pretty dramatic tilt to the right. A number of far-right parties in different EU nations are expected to make gains, but holding the line somewhat is the European People's Party, the grouping of more traditional conservatives that at the moment control 12 EU heads of state and government and are expected to top the June poll. They also count among them European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, who will be running for another five-year term, and the alliance is currently holding a two-day congress in Bucharest. Well, I'm joined now from Bucharest by the moderator of the EPP's two-day event there, Nina Dos Santos, who's also a frequent Monocle radio contributor, international broadcast correspondent, and the former CNN Europe editor. Nina, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chris. Hi.
What is the atmosphere like over there? European conservatives are pretty confident at the moment.
Yeah, the centre-right party here is essentially engaging in what other outlets like, for instance, Politico have described as a victory lap, really. Essentially, what this two-day event is set to do is to discuss policies and then adopt a manifesto. That happened yesterday. And that manifesto for the next parliamentary term looks similar to the one before, but slightly changed to address, you know, the priorities that voters here across the EU appear to feel extremely keenly about. That's obviously, in particular, the issue of migration. Asylum claims to EU countries have spiked by 18% just in the last year alone. And of course, with the war in Ukraine, the issues between Israel and Gaza, and the room for broader strife in other parts of the Middle East, there's concerns that Europe might face another migration wave crisis, much as it did back in 2015 and 2016. And one of the other things that they're addressing in this manifesto as well is how to sort of resell and reformulate and take to the next stage that Green New Deal. You remember that was the big unveil and reveal the first time that Ursula von der Leyen became the centre-right candidate for the European Commission role. She is likely to speak later on today and officially be nominated as the reconfirmed as the party's candidate for that crucial role. And as they get more seats, they will be able to exert as a party more leverage over key parts of the EU machinery, like not just the parliament, where, as you pointed out before, Malta's Roberta Metsola is president of the European Parliament, and she's also a crucial EPP centre-right member, but also the Commission, via Ursula von der Leyen and perhaps gain other commission positions as well.
Nina, there is an extremely delicate balancing act for conservative, centre-right conservatives in Europe, isn't there? Sort of holding the line against the far right without becoming the far right in the process. When you talk about that manifesto, how are they parsing that? What makes them different from the parties that are to the right of them?
I think this is where the issue of migration tops that manifesto as a result. It's a situation politically that we're seeing in other countries that are no longer part of the EU, like, for instance, a post-Brexit Britain, where the Conservative Party, which is not in the ascendant, according to the polls, it is in the descendant back in the UK. But still, again, we're seeing centre-right politicians having to engage the far right on issues of migration time and time again, and also to try and formulate some kind of response for people in farmers, people in the agriculture sector, people who are dealing with rising, spiking costs of living thanks to the high costs of energy and food price inflation that we've seen thanks to the war in Ukraine over the last couple of years. So all of these types of groups in the electorate are extremely sensitive to those sort of populist arguments, simple solutions often offered for complex problems. And solving those problems is even more complex if you're dealing with 27 member states with their own sort of sovereignties and their own different economic makeups and their own individual bilateral priorities with other countries outside of the EU. So they're very aware of the fact that the main concern here is to try and be seen to embrace and some of the concerns that voters who might be sympathetic to the further right movements might have, to address them, but also to not necessarily swallow all of the policies that the far right is espousing, particularly in places like France, where Marine Le Pen and Jordan Bardella's National Rally Party has sort of tried to appear to move slightly more towards the mainstream, dropping those more aggressive ideas like a Frexit, taking France out of the EU. All of those types of ideas mean that the far right is in some big EU countries where the center ground like France has been torpedoed, that they are moving slighter, at least in appearances, towards the center. And that is a threat, obviously, for the center right in this region.
Now, they are expected to endorse a second term for Ursula von der Leyen, the Commission President, as you mentioned. She's going to be speaking there later today. What is her pitch likely going to be, and how will it differ from the first term?
Well, I remember covering her first term, and obviously the big priority there was talking about green initiatives. She floated this huge Green New Deal to sort of repurpose Europe for a new green technological future that would be environmentally friendly. Obviously, that reflected German politics as well, with the rising power of the Green Party and movement among young people in Germany as well. She addressed that in her first term. But I think here it's going to be more of a pivot towards defense. Obviously, security and defense is the order of the day at this summit. And it's been highlighted, of course, by what happened in Odessa in Ukraine just yesterday, as this conference opened. By the way, we're going to have the Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis on stage in just a couple of hours from now, also Ursula von der Leyen as well, and other centre-right heads of state and government. And obviously, the Greek Prime Minister visiting Ukraine witnessed a missile strike a building just 500 metres away from where he and President Zelensky were. That just brings home the concerns that EU leaders have about just how close the war in Ukraine could get towards the EU's borders. Obviously, they have to show that they're united, but there will be divisions in terms of who wants what. And in particular, I'm focusing in on this idea that Ursula von der Leyen will pitch later today of having a joint defence, a commissioner inside the executive arm of the EU, which is the European Commission. There will be some discussions behind the scenes, presumably, about what exactly that commissioner can do. Will they only be able to buy weaponry? And if so, she says she wants to see it bought from the Europeans, not from the United States. But different members of the EU use different types of weaponry and have different deals with different countries, and particularly in particular US defense providers. And there's real concerns that the EU weapon making supply chain can't cope. Already there's evidence that it can't make enough shells to give to Ukraine. And so they're going to be talking a lot about how to secure the EU's borders, how to secure, make people feel secure in their homes and on their streets. Obviously, that will include the topic of migration, and also how to ramp up and scale up the EU defence industry, of which at the moment inside the bloc, only France is a big player. The question is whether or not France and other countries will want to play ball and be united on that front.
Nina, speaking of defence, what has there been any reaction over there to Donald Trump becoming the presumptive Republican nominee in the United States? Because he obviously has made waves with his own comments suggesting that Europe might be on its own, or certain countries might be on their own when it comes to that defence.
Well, we haven't had big public statements by senior members of government. All of the heads of government are actually going to be speaking later on today, so we'll have their speeches, but it's unlikely that they're going to address that head on in speeches. They'll probably focus on issues that are, you know, that their electorate will be listening, tuning into for the EU parliamentary elections in the next few months' time. But there have been a lot of bilateral negotiations behind the scenes. As I said, this manifesto was adopted very quickly. They appear to have everybody on board. So that leaves room for talking behind the scenes about how exactly to tackle those kind of knotty problems. It really is the elephant in the room, how to deal with the United States, a potential United States president who might retrench from the US's traditional role in security in this part of the world. I'm in Romania, which, you know, was one of those countries that has been transformed enormously by the enlargement of the EU. But none of that would have been possible without the, you know, the end of the Cold War. And in this part of the world, there's real concerns that another Cold War is starting. And what kind of role an America would play in that under Donald Trump is something that leaders here know they have to get their heads around. And they also have to show a united front on as well.
Nina Dos Santos in Bucharest, thank you very much for joining us. This is The Globalist. It is 7:12 in London and 9:12 in Kyiv. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky hasn't been shy about visiting the front lines over the past 2 years of the war in Ukraine and putting his life at risk in the process. But yesterday he came extremely close to suffering the consequences. Explosions struck near a convoy with Zelensky and Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis in the port city of Odessa, in what is believed to be an attempt by Russia to assassinate the Ukrainian president. Journalist Natalia Humenyuk can tell us more. She's down the line from the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. Natalia, thanks for coming on the show. How close was this?
There are different accounts. They're speaking about a few hundred meters. But I think the most important is to understand that it's not like something very special happened yesterday, because the similar attacks on Odessa ports are happening all the time. Yes, it's very unfortunate that in the port, we understand there is information about five person died somewhere. We should understand the port is rather big infrastructure object, and it is constantly shelled due to the reason that Ukraine is trying to still move various goods, including the grain, through the Black Sea. And, you know, just 4 days ago on March 2nd in Odessa, you know, 12 people, including five children, died during the night attack. So it's we can just speculate whether it was the, you know, attempt of the assassination or a usual morning bombing of Odessa port.
Well, one thing that's striking throughout this, I mean, foreign leaders often do come for visits, and I do understand, or is it not true that Russia typically will be alerted to this to some degree so that they do not potentially also kill a foreign leader? I mean, did this not happen this time, or can we sort of infer from that perhaps this was on purpose?
The difference is that a lot of foreign visits come to Kyiv, and Kyiv has a better air defense. So if you would remember, there was, for instance, the visit of the African leaders, and Kyiv was shelled when Biden was there. And you know, these things happened. It just, like in Kyiv, the air defense is better. Odessa cannot afford it. It still has it, but of course there is the, let's say, some temptation to bring the maritime leaders of the countries like Odessa, for whom of like Greece, from whom Odessa is a very relevant place to show, because, you know, there was recently the news about the Turkish vessel attacked in one of the Black Sea ports of Ukraine, which are partially blocked.
And I mean, Natalia, can you tell us a little more about what kind of precautions are taken for Zelensky when he travels? What does he typically do when he's on these trips to either the front line or a port city like Odessa?
So, first of all, we know the news about this attack hours after it has happened. That's also very clear that there would be nowhere any information about any trip beyond a very small circle of the people around the president, even if there is some knowledge about the possible trip somewhere. Usually we always know anywhere they go just sometime after it happened, and like everything is published with the delay. But of course there is a security, there is a limited amount of the people traveling, but there is no other way to defend from ballistic missiles rather than the air defense, disregarding who is it. Of course, there is a precautious about the, moving to the basement, and if there is an air alert, there is at this moment, Ukrainians are able to understand what type of threat is there. Is it like ballistic missile? Is it the Shahed drone? So, you know, like there is an understanding of the timing, how much you can do for moving to a safer spot.
Natalia Homeniuk in Kyiv, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Globalist. It is 7:17 in London and 3:17 a.m. in Caracas. For months, the United States has been prodding Venezuela to hold free and fair elections in exchange for a relaxation of U.S. sanctions. While yesterday Venezuela followed through with the elections part, setting a date of 28th of July, but whether they will be free or fair is another matter. President Nicolas Maduro is expected to run again, while the main opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, remains barred from holding office, and opposition leaders have been given only 19 days to register candidates to replace her. Well, I'm joined by Andrew Thompson, a journalist and political risk analyst specializing in Latin America. Andrew, this election date is earlier than expected. Why is that?
Well, the Barbados agreements between Venezuela and government and opposition said the elections would have to be in the second half of this year, and they are just in the second half. And I think what we're seeing is that the Venezuelan government is basically trying to ensure things go its own way, and it's manipulating kind of all sorts of aspects of the elections. One example, the Barbados agreement said there had to be international observation of the elections with the European Union and the Organization of American States. By choosing such an early date, it's basically impossible for the European Union to get its technical team ready in time. So the international observation of the polls is going to be very limited and perhaps might not exist at all.
Interesting. And what are the chances of opposition leader Maria Corina Machado getting her ban lifted, particularly in 19 days when she has to register?
Prospects of that happening look very low. I think the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro is a past master at dividing the opposition. So what they always try and do is create some point of tension which will divide the opposition vote and cause a crisis which plays to their advantage. So they'll be able to say, well, we went ahead with the elections, as agreed, that was all part of the deal we did, Unfortunately, the opposition split, decided to boycott the elections, whatever, and excluded itself.
Well, and will that work in your mind this time? I mean, who else might the opposition agree on? Do you expect them to try, or might they consider the opposite, what you just mentioned, boycotting the poll altogether?
I think they'll be divided over it, and that's precisely why the government is going down that pathway. One option, for example, would be for Maria Corina Machado to say, well, I'm being excluded, but I nominate a proxy candidate who will run on my behalf. The likelihood is that she won't do that. She'll remain stuck on what is, for a large part of the opposition, an issue of principle. She is the most popular opposition candidate. She won overwhelmingly in primaries held last October. Therefore, she won't step down. If the government insists on excluding her, which I think it will insist on excluding her, then the agreement, the Barbados agreement, will break down. And I think, unfortunately, that at the moment is the most likely outlook. There will be other presidential candidates, but they will be, if you like, promoted by the government as a sort of window dressing exercise.
Well, and if the Barbados agreement then breaks down, as you suggest, is any of this likely to impress the United States at all when it comes to relaxing sanctions on Venezuela, or would you expect them to step up sanctions at this point?
Well, I think there's a key date, which is the 18th of April, when the US has said it's going to review its existing sanctions and what are called sanction rollbacks, which are temporary suspensions. So by that date, the US will have to say what it believes about the democratization process in Venezuela. And everything again points to the US saying, well, the relaxation of sanctions is off because you haven't fulfilled some of the basic conditions of the agreement.
And just finally, Andrew, I mean, given all of that, what is the motivation in your mind for Nicolas Maduro? I mean, does he care at this point? Why enter into a Barbados agreement at all if he was going to do this?
I think of him a bit as a fox, a very crafty politician who is dedicated to holding on to power for himself, like a lot of dictators. And he periodically oscillates between hardline repression and sort of opening up and saying perhaps we could do a deal. That's part of what he represents. So there'll always be a potential deal, then, oh no, we're going to crack down and we're going to tighten control on power. It's kind of part of who he is as a politician.
Andrew Thompson, thank you very much for joining us. Still to come in the program:
one of Singapore's many luxury hotels will start reimbursing guests for a night's stay if their plans are ruined by wet weather. But there's a catch. I'm Lillian Fawcett, Monocle's associate producer, recently returned from the city-state, and I'll be telling you more about this inventive scheme and what's changing in Singapore's luxury hotel market.
We'll have more from Lillian later, plus a look at plans to reform university education in Greece. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me from Nairobi is the multimedia journalist Navina Couture. Navina, great to have you on the program as always. Let's start with, the Houthi missile attacks in Yemen have actually this time killed three people.
Yes, from what we understand from U.S. Central Command, three crew members have been killed in a missile strike on a cargo ship that was reportedly abandoned and drifting with a fire on board after the strike. Four people are said to be injured, and the Barbados-flagged carrier was carrying steel from China to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. I think we have to wait and see if this will result in more strikes attacks by the US-led naval task force that has been shooting down many of these missiles that are coming from the Houthis, or if the US military will resort to different tactics this time.
It's also quite striking, as you mentioned there, that this was a ship coming from China. Is that likely to have any impact on this crisis?
I doubt it. It also doesn't look like the missile strike was destined to really kill people. I think the majority of these missile strikes are basically intended to stop the traffic, and they have really, really achieved that in the last couple of months. I think what is also striking is that even though there have been attempts to shoot down so many of these missiles and drones that are coming from the Houthis, it seems to be almost impossible to destroy every single one. So I think it will call into question how efficient this US-led campaign of airstrikes really is when it comes to targeting these Houthi launch sites.
Well, let's move on to Senegal, because there's been another twist in the political crisis over there. The government has announced the country's presidential election will take place on the 24th of March.
Yes, exactly. I think the sigh of relief was really palpable, not just in Senegal, but across the region. It's important to remember that Senegal is the only country in mainland West Africa that has never experienced a military coup. It has always been seen as a very stable democracy, but in the last couple of months, there have been protests after the current president, Macky Sall, postponed the election last month. There were protests outside parliament. There was tension. And last night, the current president announced that there will be an election on the 24th of March. He also said that the government candidate, Prime Minister Amadou Ba, will be leaving government now so that he can focus on his election campaign, and that this election, that his tenure will actually end on the 2nd of April, so a couple of days after this election has taken place.
I mean, is this then one finally good news story, as it were, for the region, in the sense then that protests actually worked and brought Senegal back from the brink?
I think it is. There was a lot of diplomatic pressure and popular pressure on Macky Sall to not run again for office. It was reported that last year the former US President Barack Obama was sent by the White House to Senegal to talk Macky Sall out of running again. So I think it shows that, I mean, we've seen these protests not just in the last month, but the people just don't want him to run. They're really unhappy with his tenure, and they've suffered from rising prices. They feel that the revenues that have come into the government coffers haven't really benefited the ordinary public. So I think it does go to show that probably diplomacy and public pressure in conjunction can actually make a difference.
Well, let's move on to one other story from the Sahel. The junta-led states there, Niger, Mali and Burkina Faso, are joining forces to fight insurgents.
Yes, they. All of these countries have experienced a coup. They're now running. They're now being run by military governments, and these governments have decided to set up a joint task force to tackle security threats across the territory. All these three countries have major security problems with both Al Qaeda as well as groups that have pledged allegiance to ISIS. They have not been able to get these under control and have been working previously with European governments, primarily with the French government. And now they are trying to basically tackle these issues themselves. I think we have to wait and see if they make any progress, because the area is vast, and so far they haven't been very efficient at approaching some of these security concerns.
Given that lack of efficiency, as you're describing it there, I mean, do you get any sense that any of these three countries might be regretting kicking France out of the country, given that this was what France was doing, fighting insurgents?
I'm not entirely sure that they're already regretting kicking France or kicking France out of the country or ending military cooperation with France. I think these military governments are now under pressure to show that the reason why they basically took over in order to tackle the security concerns, as they have said themselves, that they're able to do so. There is, though, concern in the region and also outside the region that these countries will turn increasingly to Russia for military support. And that we will see a heavier Russian military presence in these countries, as we have in the Central African Republic, in Sudan and in other countries.
Yeah, Russia's role in this has been extremely interesting as well. But let's move on to one other story for now. We're going to Kenya, which is starting to use humor to counter some of the unpopular state policies.
Yes, I think we've talked about this on the program several times in the past. The country is experiencing tax rises. The government has to repay debt and is basically trying to collect as much taxes as possible. And Kenyans they've always resorted to humor, but in this case, they've been referring to President William Ruto now as Zacchaeus, named after the infamous Zacchaeus from the Bible, the much hated tax collector in Jericho. He's also been called Kaunda Ungo Man, sort of in reference to the suits he's wearing, but also to the Kiswahili word Ungo, which means liar and man. So he's not a very popular politician right now, but there's still the political space to criticize him in this way.
And they've been using sort of memes, as I understand. Is that right? What's your favorite that you've come across?
I mean, I have to say the Zacchaeus meme is quite charming. President Ruto actually acknowledged that it is a very difficult time, that he's happy to be called Zacchaeus after the tax collector when he was traveling in Japan and pressed about the need for these tax cuts. He said this is what the country now has to do, and that he's okay with the meme and the name that he's been given.
That's quite striking in itself, isn't it? Yeah. That they're using humor, but the president is actually leaning into it. Is that right?
Yes, I think he really doesn't have much of a choice. He does have to increase the tax base. And I think he knows that rather than basically cracking down on it or criticizing it, it's easier to deal with it with a sense of humor than too earnestly.
Navina Couture, thank you very much for joining us. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. The U.S. Supreme Court says it will hear arguments on whether Donald Trump is immune from prosecution on the 25th of April. Lower courts have rejected the former president's immunity claims over federal charges that he sought to overturn the 2020 election. Taiwan's defense ministry says China has increased gray zone warfare by saturating the waters surrounding the island with boats, balloons, and drones. Taiwan accuses China of what it calls irregular tactics, seeking to undermine the democratic island short of invading. And Australia and Vietnam have upgraded their relations to a comprehensive strategic partnership. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's comments came as Australia is seeking cooperation on rare earth minerals to diversify away from China. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. It is time now for our continuing series ahead of the 10-year anniversary tomorrow of the disappearance of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370. And today we head to the very heart of the story, Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, where we're joined live by the journalist Adam Hancock, who's reporting on this story. Adam, great to have you on the show. Let's start with the fact that there was already a memorial held last weekend. Tell us about that first.
Yes, that was took place here in Kuala Lumpur on Sunday, and it was a gathering of family and friends and other loved ones of people who were on board the plane. It's something that's pretty much happened most years around the time of March the 8th, which is the date when flight MH370 went missing. And it's an opportunity really for those family and friends to come together, reflect on what has happened, try and find some comfort in the presence of each other. But I was speaking this morning to a lady called Grace, who her mother was on the flight, and she is effectively the spokesperson for the families of the people on MH370. And she said it's all self-funded. It's all organized by the families. There's no input from the authorities here. And really, that will be about it in terms of tributes. We're not expecting anything tomorrow on March the 8th here in Kuala Lumpur. So that event on Sunday, the 10-year anniversary event, is probably about it, really.
Well, it's quite striking that you say this is all self-funded. I mean, what in your sense then do the families think of the role that the Malaysian government plays in this?
Yeah, I think there is disappointment that more is not being done really to mark the occasion. And, you know, even there's no permanent memorial. I was asking this morning, is there anywhere where I could go and film where there would be tributes left to people on the plane or even at the international airport here? But no, it's all taking it down. And actually, Grace was telling me that a lot of the materials that you might see at these events that you may have seen photos on in the media, for example, that they all end up at her house. She said her house is effectively a museum to a lot of the events that have taken place to remember. I think there is frustration still at the authorities here for what is perceived as a lack of work done to continue to find this plane. We had a new line at the weekend from the transport minister that there was an indication that the government would be willing to reopen the investigation. But I spoke to an expert who's followed this story for the last 10 years. I spoke to him yesterday, and he was telling me that this is something that regularly comes up around March the 8th, almost as if it's to appease the families and make them feel that something is being done. So whether or not those words will be followed up on is something definitely to watch in the coming weeks.
And what do the families think about then that in itself, the idea that the search might be reopened? I mean, would that kind of open an old wound for them? Have they been able to make any sort of peace with this situation, given also the way you're describing what the Malaysian government does here, kind of often suggesting that investigation might start again and then not following through?
I think certainly from the family members that I have spoken to, that there is a desire for the search to continue. I think that the majority would say they would prefer that rather than the potential pain it might cause. I think many of the family members have a feeling that, or a view that, there is unfinished business when it comes to the search for this plane. Obviously, the wreckage has never been found, only a few small pieces of the plane that have washed up on remote beaches. So I think really there's a strong desire for the investigation to open, for new technology to be used. There's a marine robotics company in the US called Ocean Infinity. They have previously searched parts of the Indian Ocean for the plane, but once again, they have offered the Malaysian government effectively a no-find, no-fee deal to try and find the plane. So I think that the families, to get any sort of closure, really, and whilst they may be, you know, dealing with the grief and coming to terms with the fact that they won't see their loved ones again, to get a complete closure, I think they really want to know what happened, or they really want to know where the wreckage ended up. And that might start to be able to allow investigators to piece together, you know, what their loved ones, what their final hours look like.
Well, and Adam, we have been speaking to people here as well this week who believe that they have narrowed the location of the plane. But I do wonder how much that is reaching Malaysia. Is there a perception there among the families, experts, the government for that matter, that there is enough new evidence to launch another search?
Yeah, I think particularly amongst the families, they're obviously holding on to any sort of new evidence or any new theories that are taking place. Yesterday, I was speaking to an aviation expert who was saying that a British engineer has pinpointed an area around 1,500 kilometres off the coast of Perth, which hasn't been searched yet. And through amateur radio signals, he's pretty sure that he's picked up a flight path. So I think, understandably for the families, anybody who's coming forward with a theory or a new location, they're very keen for those areas to be searched. It's interesting that the transport minister did flag the possibility that the investigation, that the official investigation in Malaysia could be reopened, because that may indicate that perhaps they think there are new leads that they could follow. I must add, though, that the Prime Minister in Malaysia, he was speaking at the ASEAN summit taking place in Melbourne this week. He kind of reined things in a little bit compared to what the Transport Minister said, more taking the approach that if there is credible evidence and new emerging evidence, then Malaysia would be willing to reopen the case. Rather than the Transport Minister, he was a bit more forward in saying he was going to put a proposal to the Cabinet about reopening the case and getting on board with Ocean Infinity again.
And just finally, Adam, I mean, what would it mean, do you think, to these families if 10 years on the plane was actually found?
I think ultimately it would provide closure. I think it would allow them to be able to almost move on from this. Always, obviously, they're always going to have the pain, they're always going to have the grief, and they will always have the memories of their loved ones. But I think, like Grace was telling me this morning, it's still grief, you know, whether or not a relative of yours dies of natural causes at the age of 90. It's grief all the same, and everyone is sharing that grief. But for them, just not knowing, having so much mystery, being angry and frustrated at some of the mistakes that were made early on, being frustrated at the investigation, for them, I think if the wreckage was found, was discovered and the trail of the plane could be kind of pieced together, it would just allow them to kind of almost draw a line under this and just focus fully on remembering their loved one rather than having to constantly read about theories and speculation and investigations potentially reopening and the emotional roller coaster that brings.
Adam Hancock in Kuala Lumpur, thank you very much for joining us. And you can hear a full episode on the disappearance of MH370 tomorrow on the Monocle Weekly. You're with Monocle Radio. In Greece, some 15,000 students have been protesting in the capital this week while also occupying around 150 universities. The protests are about plans to allow international private universities to open branches in Greece and compete with public ones that are cheaper but also underfunded. Greece's parliament is due to debate and vote on the reform bill today. Our newsletter editor, Manos Papavasiliou, is in the studio with us and can tell us more. Manos, let's start with just what universities are like in Greece. How happy are people with the existing quality? How happy were you?
To be honest, people in Greece are not happy at all. So universities in Greece at the moment, as we mentioned, are all state-funded. But they have been plagued by, you know, a lot of underfunding, a lot of them being run down. The standards are not up to their compared to international institutions. And that's what the government is trying to do right now to, you know, in a bid to bring foreign institutions that can upgrade the system of education here. Personally, because I wanted a higher education that is better for myself, I chose to study abroad because I could. And that is because if you have the means in Greece, it is better to go outside and study in, you know, international institutions, foreign universities, rather than stay there. And that is why, you know, that is why a lot of students are protesting today, because they know that the competition is not up to scratch. They know that the foreign institutions that can potentially come over will be able to perform better than the existing state of universities.
Well, that is absolutely the challenge, isn't it, that makes this so interesting, because there are the two ways you can tackle this. People are leaving Greece, and so the government wants people to study in Greece instead, which would be potentially attractive to students. But as you say, they also are protesting the fact that their own universities are not very good. What is the government kind of doing to try and appease that? Are they promising additional funding for those public universities?
So at the same time with trying to bring foreign institutions to set up branches in Greece, the government has actually announced about 1 billion in euros to support the current state of the state-funded universities. But still, people are not 100% convinced that this was going to bring any change. That is because of the way state universities are run at the moment. They're plagued by a lot of, like, you know, politics being interwoven there, a lot of the fact that, you know, teachers are public servants, they cannot be fired, there is no such thing as, you know, evaluating of teachers. The standards are not up to there. And the thing is that students are protesting because they believe that this is going to create a two-tiered education system in which, you know, more well-off families can potentially get better degrees than them. However, at the moment, as you mentioned, the people who can and have the ability to study in better universities, they travel abroad. So with this plan, the government is saying, why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't they stay here? At the same time, it can bring a lot of investment. It can bring a lot of international students. And, you know, don't have to funnel all that money outside of Greece. And it's true. It's a way that, you know, you can up the soft power of a country. For example, let's say an institution such as Cambridge or Oxford. which I'm not saying they're coming, but they could potentially set up brunches. If you're studying the classics and if you have the means to like attend one of those places, why wouldn't you want to travel as an international student, come to Greece and study just under the Acropolis?
Absolutely, I would take that. But just finally, Manos, what is this parliament debate going to be like, do you expect? Is there going to be tension within that, or is this basically a done deal?
I think there's going to be a lot of tension because nearly all the opposition parties are opposing this. But given that New Democracy, the ruling party, has a huge majority in the parliament, it has a big potential that it will actually pass. And therefore, it's going to set up the new standard for the 2025-2026 education schedule.
Manos Papavasiliou, thank you very much for joining us. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Well, it is now time on the show to look at the latest news on urbanism and cities with urban affairs commentator Kat Hanna. Kat, thanks so much for coming on the show. We're going to start with a story from Bloomberg about why so many cities right now have a lot of car washes.
Yeah, good morning. So this struck me as an interesting story featured in Bloomberg, exactly as you said, looking not just at cities, but their suburbs in particular, and seeing effectively a huge increase in the number of car washes, often run by quite established, you know, chains focusing on automation, but actually how some of the communities are responding and highlighting that in some locations we're seeing what is essentially a saturation ban. So communities and, you know, local political leaders actually pushing back on new operations opening in their location because they're feeling that they've already kind of hit peak car wash.
Well, how have we hit peak car wash only now, I have to ask? Like, the cars have been a part of cities for so long, and if anything, cars are kind of in the descendancy right now. So where is this coming from?
Absolutely. And as you said, you know, in some ways you think, well, obviously there's a lot of car washes in the US, given, you know, the absolutely vast number of private vehicles that there are. So as the article highlights, part of this is potentially, you know, related to COVID. In terms of, again, people's lifestyles, how they spend their days changing in terms of spending more time around their suburban homes, this being something that you can go and do because it is automated. But also actually looking at essentially, you know, these are quite a good investment. So where private equity is going in, where investors are going in, it is proving incredibly popular. So there's a parallel made in the article with something like Starbucks. And again, if you think about, you know, the initial ascendancy of Starbucks, people have said, well, we've had coffee around for ages. Who wants to go and spend this much money on coffee? Do we really need this many? And the answer largely was, well, actually, yes, the demand is there. And it's, you know, highlighting the same. It's a very profitable industry. It's very scalable. And demand does continue to seem to be there. And there's also about innovation and what a car wash can offer. One thing that struck me highlights an example of car washes that are absolutely enormous, almost the size of kind of a football pitch. You go, you've got EV charging, you've got play spaces for kids. So this is also just about changing how we use some of that urban infrastructure as well. And this being, you know, another new use.
Well, let's look at one other story that you brought that's close to my heart as a sort of New Yorker. But the New York Times is saying that New York is back, or asking whether New York is back.
Exactly. And this was this article struck me in the New York Times because it was quite a degree of positivity, like you said, around the capital. But what actually the article unpicks is, well, what do we mean by back? What are some of the measures that you can use to understand what that might mean? And actually, What does that mean for people and the various, you know, multiple communities that we have making up a city like New York? So the article highlights on a few kind of key metrics, whether it's tourism, jobs growth, subway ridership. We're actually definitely seeing some positives and also including in things like bonuses being paid and then that having a positive impact, obviously, on the tax base for the city. So definitely some reasons for positivity there. And it's been very allied to essentially a bit of a partnership and collaboration approach between, you know, in particular Mayor Eric Adams and the city's businesses, you know, and the line kind of taken as that helping businesses thrive is essential to the city's comeback. But then what the article kind of takes a step back and says, yeah, but how's that actually being felt in various parts of New York? So looking, for example, about concerns around crime, particularly, you know, in public spaces and on the subway, looking at the quality of those new jobs being created and saying, actually, whilst the numbers may tell us one thing, is that actually what everyone's lived experience of New York is? And as the article highlights, the answer is probably not. And, you know, I don't think this is something that's unique to New York. Again, in how do you assess and take that temperature of a city in terms of what it means to be back?
Well, and absolutely, I can say when I was there towards the end of last year, there was a feeling in New York to some degree that some crime has returned as you relate to there. And also there's this worry about office occupancy in the downtown since the pandemic. Is that something that's improved?
Not substantially, which is quite interesting. And obviously, again, you know, it's still, I think the article highlights some figures looking at around, you know, 20 to 25% in Manhattan, just to give some context in somewhere like the City of London. Vacancy is down around 7-8%. So, you know, still actually really quite high. But again, what we are seeing, though, is obviously some emphasis on footfall. So there are some kind of positives there. But again, I don't think it is enough to necessarily, you know, overnight, you know, change also that perception point you raised, you know, feelings about perception of crime being up or of spaces not being used as they were previously is sometimes often as important as what the actual numbers are telling us as well.
Well, you mentioned London there, and let's move on to one story from there as well. The UK has unveiled its budget yesterday, and one aspect of this is what Canary Wharf is getting.
Yeah, so I should say it's early days in terms of, you know, digesting everything that was in the budget yesterday. And as is always the case, you know, the devil is in the detail. But one area that's been getting particularly attention and covered in the FT by Josh Oliver was highlighting that of a loan from the Housing Infrastructure Fund, so essentially, you know, a government loan to support the development of a life sciences centre and obviously new housing at Canary Wharf. And it's, you know, it's not the only measure that's actually been given to London. There's also a substantial loan that's been given for a lot of housing in Barking Riverside, so a kind of quintessential brownfield development in East London, delivering a huge number of homes. But obviously, what's been quite interesting is how this has been playing out in terms of the UK narrative around, OK, well, we've had a lot of discussion around levelling up and that narrative. And now we're seeing obviously quite significant amounts of money being loaned to a capital city, and especially an area like Canary Wharf, where you have to think in a lot of people's kind of consciousnesses, this is, you know, this is shiny towers, this is bankers, this is traders. It is not an area, if you say levelling up and the area is in need of investment, it is not necessarily the sort of thing you'd look at. That's not to say that, you know, there's not a rationale for giving that money, but it certainly raised a few question marks.
Kat Hanna, thanks very much for joining us. You are listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio. And finally, on today's show, if you've ever planned a short city vacation to a new destination and gotten washed out by rain, you're going to enjoy this next item, because the Intercontinental Hotel in Singapore is offering a new Rain Resist Bliss package that offers a free night to any guests whose trip to the city-state was interrupted by too much rain. Lillian Fawcett is Monocle's associate producer, who just returned from a stint in Singapore and joins me right here in the studio. Good morning, Lillian.
Good morning, Chris.
What are the details, tell me, of this new policy? Is there sort of a fine print to it?
Well, certainly, as you might expect with
many of these kind of policies. It's not quite all that it seems. So the hotel, we will reimburse guests for the equivalent of one night stay if their trip, if their plans are affected by wet weather. But that's only if it rains for 120 cumulative minutes in a 4-hour period. So Singapore does rain a lot. It's a tropical city. But I'm not clear on who is going to be working out whether or not those 120 cumulative minutes have been met. I can't imagine they've put staff on in the hotel to work this out.
A partnership with weather groups?
Well, I don't know. We haven't had much detail on it. So I'm sure they'll be happy to provide this voucher, but that relies on visitors to be totting up those minutes when the rain does start to fall.
Puts the onus on the guests to tot up how many minutes
exactly
they've suffered. Is it that rainy? What was it like when you were there?
Yeah, the short answer is yes, it's very rainy. It's 1 degree of latitude away from the equator, so it's bang in the tropics. It rains 171 days of the year in Singapore, and that's compared to 155 in London, which we obviously think of as a very rainy city. And often the rain is incredibly heavy. It's tropical rain. So you have these big downpours, thunderstorms. But November, December and January are the rainiest months. So if people are wanting to game the system when they plan their trip to Singapore, then those are the months to maximise your chances of getting one night of your stay reimbursed.
You don't really want to go in rain in order to get a free night. But I suppose if you want to game the system, that would be one thing to do. I mean, one other aspect of this is just whether we can kind of glean anything from this about Singapore's luxury hotel market. Why are they doing this? Are they trying to bring people in, convince them to come?
Yeah, I think this is certainly part of a push to be more competitive with some of Singapore's other big luxury hotels. You know, since COVID, we've seen Singapore really recover quite well from the COVID pandemic and the travel restrictions that came on as a result of that. You know, I've reported on this show before about how Singapore Changi Airport is hoping to see visitor numbers return to pre-pandemic levels this year. So I think this is just one of the ways that InterContinental is trying to be competitive. You know, prices are going up, and that's partly because there's lots of big money flooding into Singapore away from perhaps cities elsewhere in Southeast Asia that were a bit slower to lift COVID restrictions, or maybe from Hong Kong, which is obviously seeing a lot of political turmoil. So I think we can maybe not, there's no clarity yet on whether we're going to expect to see this in InterContinental's other hotels. But I think this is just one of the ways that luxury hotels try to keep, well, firstly, keep our attention because this is getting a lot of coverage, but also try and stay competitive as well.
And just quickly, Lillian, how does this fit into the national government's tourism push? Are they also kind of pushing to get people? We talked yesterday about Taylor Swift being in Singapore.
Yes, and actually that's another thing to mention is that's being called the Taylor Swift effect, is pushing up hotel prices in the city. So that's just adding to the competition. But yeah, this policy and the coverage of it, as I say, comes at a good time for Singapore and its government. They said this week that they're investing $300 million Singapore dollars in the tourism industry, encouraging providers to develop new products, new experiences, train up more staff. And as I say, they're expecting lots more visitors this year. Their aim is 16 million, up from 13 million last year. So this is part of a big kind of tourism drive in the city.
Decent amount there. Lillian Fawcett, thanks very much for joining us here on The Globalist. And that's all we have time for on today's program. Thanks to our producers, Vincent McAvinney, Laura Kramer and Lillian Fawcett, our researcher, Neoma Akwe, and our studio manager, Christy O'Grady. After the headlines, more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday London time. The Globalist returns tomorrow. I'm Chris Chermak. Thanks for tuning in.